Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrow. Today we're talking about the young adult novel The Honeys by Ryan Lasala. A full transcript to this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Good evening, Ren. You know, one of these days we're going to do our countdown and we're going to say those numbers at the same time.
I thought we were quite close this time.
I think we got closer. I was thinking that is closer. So maybe by the time we get to episode 100, we'll be able to do our, our countdown together and we'll be totally in sync.
Yeah. It's a process. Can't rush it.
No, that's a fair point. Yeah. I watched The Possession. Oh. I watched The Substance.
Yes,
I watched The Substance.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it?
Oh, it's so horrible. I was air punching with glee by the end of it.
Yeah.
Oh, that last half an hour was exquisite. Like,
I loved it.
Yeah, when she goes all starfish face at the end.
I thought you'd enjoy the paper cut out just slammed on her face.
And the fact that this disguise. It works perfectly. Made me howl with laughter. So it's really funny because quite a lot of reviews are like, "Oh, it's a bit long." You know, that last half an hour. I was like, "No,
yeah,
what?"
No, it's like, no.
I wanted more. But the last half an hour, I was just like, "Yeah, keep going. It's found its groove."
Yeah, can she do it again?
Keep transforming. Yeah, break on through to the other side.
Yeah, it was. I kind of went to the cinema to see it. I didn't really know what it was about. I'd just seen a brief synopsis, and I was like, I kind of need a distraction. I wasn't, I was kind of having a bit of a hard time, and in the cinema watching this, and just all the noises of the audience, and something really beautiful about a whole audience.
Oh, yeah.
And going,
By the end of it, I was totally on board and thoroughly enjoyed it. So, recommended for those with a strong constitution and stomach.
Yes, seriously, heed that warning.
Don't watch it if you're feeling a little queasy.
Speaking of gloopy horror, we're here today to talk about The Honeys by Ryan Lasala, which is... On the ebook I had, it was like The Honeys, the hottest new queer YA horror book, as its title.
Well, The Honeys : the hottest new queer.
From 2022, I believe.
Yeah, so we're probably coming in after any discourse now, which is good. You know, presumably Goodreads has settled down and we can come in, see the damage that's been done, inspect the bodies and do a cool calculated assessment.
Yeah. This is another one that I just found in the YA horror section of my library app and was like, that sounds good. So I read it last year and it was good. So I suggested it for the podcast.
I think you're quite a rambling reader. I like the fact that you take things that take your fancy. I think sometimes I was trying to work through a few years back that like 1001 books you must read before you die. And those kind of books tend to have a terrible hold on me. It's like effort grades when I was a child. You must work as hard as you can at all times. If the book says you must read all these books, like, well, I mean, I really don't want to read American Psycho, but I guess if I must.
I guess you must.
I guess I must. I'm trying to actually read things I enjoy these days, so that's nice. I think this is pretty strong. It has a really startling and quite horrific opening. And then I think it gets a bit vibesy in the middle. the vibes are not immaculate, but the vibes are pretty delectable. But it does meander a little, I think. And then the ending is really strong again. So I think it could have done with a little bit of an edit, but overall, I recommend it.
A little prune in the middle, maybe. This beginning, it starts with our protagonist, Mars, short for Marshall, is viciously attacked by the twin sister Caroline crawling through their bedroom window. Mars is a gender fluid character, so he's variously he, she, or they pronouns. So Caroline crushes Mars's hand with a big vintage calculator,
not an abacus.
It's a calculator.
Not like crushed between the beads of an abacus.
It's heavier than you would think for a calculator. Slashes them across the ear. They're like, this is massive tussle, like, and then they end up both of them falling through the banister.
As happens
through the chandelier.
As happened in the 1950s Nicholas Ray melodrama Bigger Than Life. So a real deep cut for you melodrama heads there.
They fall through a banister, through a chandelier, and Caroline lands underneath Mars and dies. In this opening sequence, we sort of learn that they'd previously been very close and had drifted apart, and that Caroline has just come back from Aspen, which is this summer camp. And in the kind of aftermath of this, of her death, we learn that they're both the children of a state senator, this sort of very wealthy family who are devoted to keeping up appearances. And so sort of no sooner pretty much has Caroline died than her body is whisked away, and like the banister's repaired and the chandelier, a new chandelier is delivered, and the word gets out that she died that she had a brain tumor, and she was, but Mars is made to sort of hide their injuries and kind of pull their hair over their ear at the funeral, and just nothing about the attack sort of gets out.
I basically and you know, maybe this just shows a limited imagination when it comes to sort of American politics. But I did just imagine the parents as Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I was trying to, like, I don't have a huge grasp on a state senator. I was like, Nancy Pelosi, is that whom I am imagining? Like, I don't. Yeah, someone that the mother is like. Is like well known, you know. Like, there's a scene later where some waitresses are like, "Oh, that, you know, oh, it was her in the diner." Like,
yeah, that so, iconic senator.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, maybe imagining Hillary and Bill Clinton isn't too bad an idea.
But yes, they treat Mars with a noticeable coldness.
Hmm.
I think it becomes quickly apparent that Mars felt like the less favoured twin.
Yeah.
Well, this might be related to some mysterious incident that occurred at the summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
Of which more details are revealed gradually. Mm. But I think we're told early on that Mars had gone to Aspen when a young child or a younger child, and then has not returned since.
Mm. And then three beautiful girls from Aspen come to the funeral. And in this sort of... In this kind of trio of like of femininity, I don't know. They ask Mars if they would ever come back to Aspen, and we kind of learn a little bit about the mystery of Cabin H, which is where these girls are part of the camp that these girls are from, and where Caroline was as well. And it's sort of set like across a wildflower field, and they're responsible for the aviaries and the bees. And as they come to look at Caroline's body, and Mars sees a bee crawl out of her ear. So this is kind of just the first indication of something, or like Caroline has been acting strange.
Has she been stuffed full of bees?
Has she been stuffed full of bees?
Is she just puppeteered like the Oogie Boogie Man? not by bugs, but by bees.
Beads.
Bees?
Beads.
Beads? Bzzz. We'll see who brings in more honey.
So Mars decides they need to go back to Aspen to find out what happened. Like, why did Caroline attack them? Why had she been acting so distant? Why did a bee crawl out of her ear?
Yeah, why bees?
Why bees? What's with these girls? They kind of... And as you said, we sort of, in a sense that, like, last time Mars was at Aspen, something happened and some boys ended up getting kicked out as a result. And we kind of... And sort of one of the sort of dynamics of Mars and Aspen is that they're gender fluid and they're entering this kind of very gendered world of the camp, where there's a sort of a lot of kind of girls versus boys rivalry and kind of gendered cabins and all of this. And Mars is just kind of like, in order to get in there and to be able to try and find out what's happened, they're just like, no, just put me in with the boys, you know, I'll just do that thing, I'll do the boy thing. They like cut their hair and just like, right. This is kind of one of the dynamics of the book is like the gender fluid character in the sort of the gendered world and like the class, the upper class gendered world, because Aspen is this kind of wealthy facsimile of ruggedness, where like Mars turns up and they're like kind of realize that the water in the huts is like filtered because it's there's all these sort of touches of of luxury even in this sort of kind of fantasy of wilderness,
but like I guess trying to live out in the woods but in center parks,
yeah.
Or probably that's more exclusive than center parks. I mean, that's quite middle class, and these are very upper middle class. So I wouldn't know. You know, I don't know what these exclusive resorts are, but I'm sure they exist.
Yeah. And
I mean, it's not Butlins, that's for sure. This place.
It's not Butlins, yeah. No. So yeah, this is what we kind of get is Mars trying to assimilate into the camp and also trying to investigate the Honeys, which is the name of the group of girls who stay in Cabin H and have this kind of spell over them, like.
Well, they're very talked about, and they clearly have some high status within Aspen, but it's quite enigmatic exactly what their role is. And at times they seem like a kind of sorority, is that the word?
Sorority.
And some characters, some of the boys, like, speak, you know, quite nastily about them. But then, you know, we don't necessarily get the sense from Mars's experience with them that they're necessarily, like, stereotypical mean girls. You know, they seem like, in some ways, they can be quite welcoming, or they seem to have genuine concern for Mars. So I like the fact that it's not clear as readers how to feel about them. You know, they're intriguing, but I think it's kept very open for a long time, arguably until the end of the book, really. Exactly what to make of them, the Honeys.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. I think it would have been far easier to just go down one side or the other, to be like, okay, the Honeys, right, are just this sinister hive of evil heteronormativity, right? And that they represent everything that's kind of wrong with the dominant paradigm, or that, oh, they're wholly sinned against, and that they're this sort of powerful matriarchal force. And actually, I don't think it's doing both, basically. Like, you know, there are things to like them are about the Honeys and things to side-eye. And I think that's very deliberate. And, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's very subtle. I really enjoy how the kind of magic of their sort of realm is set up. Like, their cabin is sort of quite far away from the rest of the camp, and they've got this meadow with the aviaries, and it's sort of on the other side of the lake, which is full of lily pads, and sort of one of the kind of Mars's sort of early interactions is like them kind of kayaking over to the Honeys, and it's kind of they're sort of entering this sort of feminine land.
Yeah, it's sort of like a fairy or a fae space.
Yeah.
I liked the kind of curious game they play.
Yeah. So I was highlighting passages, and then I ended up losing half of most of my highlights, but I do have a bit about the game.
Okay, great.
So this is later in the novel, but yeah, Mars is over in the realm of the honeys, and it says, "The game they're playing is unlike anything I've ever seen. Between Bria and Mimi is a system of circular coasters and saucers made of thick ceramic and painted in bright radial designs. Upon each is a cluster of tiles, all different shapes, like piles of candy. There's some system to their placement, I sense, but that's it. The objective of the game is unclear. There doesn't even appear to be a board. Resume, Bria says. A girl off to the side lifts one willowy arm into the air, holding up a faceted crystal cup. She moves it from side to side until it catches the sun just right, projecting a flurry of rainbows onto the blanket. They skim over the saucers and tiles. Slowly she twists the etched glass, and the rainbows resolve into warping shapes, ovals and arcs that overlap in abstract patterns. It's a board for their game, I realise."
Yeah, and Mars plays this game.
Yeah, the honeys won't tell them how to play it. They just sort of have to intuit kind of the placement of stones and tiles and amid the kind of light, the shapes of light and shadow. It's quite interesting.
It's one of my favourite bits of the book. I want more intuitive games. Like, walking along the other day, I was playing an intuitive word game to myself. I was just trying to, like, link words, partly through the sound of their endings, like...
Oh, yeah.
You know, Barbarossa... now I just want to say Skibbity. See, these darn children have colonised my mind of Skibbity Toilet. That's not... Oh, dear me. Well, anyway, I like the idea of this sort of intuitive game with these sort of half-formed rules that you have to feel out, and it's really crisply but enigmatically described.
Yeah.
This sort of play of light and shadow and reflections through the glass.
You think there's a resonance there with Interstellar Pig?
Oh, maybe, actually. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something appealing about a kind of game that's evocatively but only half described. And so you have this sort of strange half-formed image in your mind imagining the game. I think...
Yeah,
I don't know, there's something really cool about that.
Yeah, that's a much earlier episode we did in Interstellar Pig by William Sleater. But yeah, also had a obscure but atmospheric game. much more central to the plot than this
one. Yeah, yeah. I mean... Should we do our text of the week?
Oh, okay, yeah.
beak, like a bird, beak! yeah, so mine is from the Honey's Realm. And it's reading a hive as 'twere a book. I really like the idea of a beehive being readable, like a book is readable, and taking out like part of the honeycomb, and that being a page, which is then readable, like at the page of a book.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really pleasing texture, like a honeycomb book.
Mm. It is beautifully written, I should just say. Like, there are some lovely descriptions in this book. Lots of textures, actually.
So, yeah, my texture is divinatory honeycomb book.
Excellent. Yeah, I think... I mean, I did have one which was a sort of description of this kind of hazy summer atmosphere of the honey's meadow, but I've lost that. You can imagine that, but I don't have the quote anymore.
So my understanding is, do you borrowed this? Like, did you borrow a digital copy from the library?
Yeah, I borrowed a digital copy from the library, and I was making highlights in it, and then my loan lapsed, and I was like, oh, it's okay, I can just re-borrow it and finish this book.
Yeah.
But then someone else had borrowed the book, which I didn't anticipate.
presumably they don't get access to your highlighting.
No.
Okay.
I lost those highlights, and yes. So I could have anticipated that, but I didn't. So
do you have a replacement texture?
I mean, there is an obvious texture.
What, the really horrible one later?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really horrible.
So I don't know if we should just...
Well, cut to the chase, or...
Or I could, like... You'll know it when we get to the horrible one.
Yeah, that's true.
This book is like, it's a lot of the time it's not horror, and then when it's horror,
yeah,
it is horror.
Yeah, no, I really agree with that. Like, there are times where I was like, oh, what? I don't know if we should be. Oh, this is more of a mystery. And then when it, yeah, gets to the body horror sections, it's. It really earns it.
Yeah. So I'll just pause my texture for a little bit.
Okay.
So there's these kind of struggles between kind of Mars and the boys going on. Like, Mars wins a fencing match against the boys, Callum, and then there's this midnight game, manhunt, where Callum comes back for revenge and assaults Mars.
These are the kind of games that terrified me when I was in the Scouts. I think they were called wide games or field games.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like having to, you know, get to a base or something while running the risk of being tackled.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of semi-illicit games that happen at Aspen, because sort of Wendy, who's the camp director, kind of talks to Mars when they first arrive and is like, you know, like, we have this very hands-off approach here at Aspen. You have to work out your problems amongst yourselves, kind of thing. So there's a lot of room for people just beating each other up in the night in the woods. That's what happens. But then Callum is beaten up in return by the Honeys, who then purge the memories of Mars and Callum.
Yeah, like the Men in Black.
Yeah. And Mars kind of has this sort of like dual kind of consciousness of, like, they're sort of aware that this happened, and they're sort of not. And they come back to this mantra of, like, Earth to Mars, which is what Caroline used to say to them. And they sort of use this to ground themselves when this kind of reality is kind of slipping.
I like the fogginess, actually, because I've kind of complained before about how modern young adult writing is often slightly too kind of clear to me, and characters always know what they're doing, and it's very sort of directed, almost like, you know, an action film. I tend to feel like that's the influence of The Hunger Games, particularly on, like, dystopian teenage literature. But one thing I really liked is the kind of fogginess of some of the sections. You know, there are bits which do become really odd and hallucinogenic, where you're not quite sure. There'll be these kind of shifts in space and time, which are quite disorienting at times in the book. Which, yeah, I really liked.
Yeah, and like Mars sort of zones out a lot. They kind of they go on a sort of 3-day hiking trip, and Mars kind of zones out on the trail and is sort of thinking of bees and death, and kind of ends up way off the path. Where sort of Wyatt, who is one of the like supervisors, I don't know, like
is Wyatt Wendy's, is Wyatt related to Wendy? Maybe
yes. Yes, I think Wyatt is Wendy's son,
yeah, or something like that.
Yeah,
like there's definitely a lot of tension as to whether Mars should trust Wyatt or not.
Yes. But he's definitely the more sympathetic of the kind of the sort of slightly older, like I guess early 20s guys who kind of supervises the hut of boys. The other one, Braden, is just yeah, very on board with any I don't know, like insults, assaults.
Insults, you know, assaults, yeah.
Yeah, so so Wyatt is kind of the yeah the closest thing that Mars has to an ally among the boys.
Yeah.
And so another sort of so weird thing that happens on this hike is that Mars has another showdown with Callum and like ends up punching him and sort of hurting their own hand in the process. But they found like a small jar of honey at the bottom of their pack, and they eat it with Wyatt because they're like, oh, this will attract bears, like we can't have this. And they sort of share this moment of eating this honey in the forest, and they kind of find that the honey has healed their hand.
There isn't any moment after this where he says to any of the boys, killing me won't give you back your goddamn honey. But, you know, I did think of Nicolas Cage shouting that in the command, obviously.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you just sent me a nice Nicolas Cage Wicker Man drag.
Yeah, it's an Australian drag king called, I need to credit because this is, because I love this so much. called Randy Roy, who posted an Instagram reel of clips of them doing a drag act inspired by Nicolas Cage in the Wicker Man remake. including Not the Bees to the tune of Let It Be, and it's very good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. so what's on my mind? Yeah.
Do you think there was more room for bee puns in this novel?
I mean, I don't think there were any bee puns.
I don't think there were any bee puns.
No, I think it was that was not the vibe.
Like where when they go to a kind of dance, like sort of formal dance party, no one says, "Oh, is this going to be like a Busby Berkeley dance?" for instance, which you know they could have done.
Be my baby.
Yeah. None of the characters make bee puns, despite ample opportunities, to be honest.
We did read another bee thing, didn't we? The Roald Dahl.
With the royal jelly.
With the royal jelly, yeah. Yeah, it's not the first appearance of bees.
No, bee horror. Yeah.
Bee horror.
Yeah, I mean. I mean, we're not going to do a spin-off podcast because, you know, we struggle enough getting episodes out of this one. So, but you know, there could be a B-based horror podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If any listeners, if any of you want to start one, I think that's a good idea.
So yeah, there's I think there's a midnight, there's another sort of midnight ritual thing, and
yeah, they don't get much sleep, do they, in this book? They're always they don't get much sleep. Like
no, they're always doing a midnight ritual.
They're always up to things, like yeah, at night, like going off secret dangerous games, and yeah, I did think, oh god, these poor teenagers, they are sleep deprived.
Mars hears Caroline screams from a Bluetooth speaker in the woods, but no one will admit to doing it. So yeah. And so Mars tells Wendy about it, and she's very dismissive. And but they end up kind of threatening. They end up threatening her with legal action over what happened 4 years ago, which we finally learn is that the boys tied Mars to the victory board, which is this. The Victory Cup is sort of the big tournament that happens that was previously called Battle of the Sexes, and it was renamed to the Victory Cup after this incident when the boys tied Mars to the victory board and set fire to it. There were no consequences of this.
Well, it's just that is just banter, isn't it?
It's just banter.
It's just harmless banter.
Yeah. Yes, Mars does bring this up to Wendy.
Yeah, quite reasonably, I think.
Quite reasonably, yeah. And sort of Mars is getting closer to the Honeys, like they swap clothes with them and kind of invited into their circle at the party.
Yeah, it's quite a heartwarming scene that actually, because
yeah,
it's not a book with many heartwarming scenes, but that bit's quite sweet.
There's this kind of anecdote about how Caroline and Mars used to swap clothes at parties when they were little, as a kind of and sort of dance together, and this was just like their little sort of childhood protest against the kind of stuffy atmosphere of their having to be nice and proper little children for their parents.
Oh, deaf to the heteronormative paradigm. As our mutual friend Ali had inscribed on their iPod, which I always remember because Ali then had to describe this to a police officer after their iPod was nicked, who said, "Hetero what now?"
Yeah. as I'm sure Mars's parents would.
Yes, indeed.
Mars is allowed to major in apiculture, i.e. bees. So they go to the meadow, but it sort of turns out that no one knows who Sierra is anymore. Who's one of the Honeys? She was one of the ones at the funeral, and when Mars first kayaks over through the lily pads, like she sort of takes them up to her bedroom and like paints their nails with this blue color that was Caroline's favorite nail polish color. So they've had these quite tender moments with her, but now no one knows who Sierra is anymore. And this is sort of where this strange psychedelic game comes in. They kind of play this game with Mimi and Bria and the others, and sort of through this game it uncovers the truth about Sierra and that she's dead in the woods. Mars sees this vision of her. And then they wipe Mars's memories again. So there's quite a lot of this kind of back and forth and push and pull of Mars sort of slowly figuring things out and then unfiguring them, and kind of a lot of fuzziness.
I liked it. I don't know, I've not really experienced that quite in that way in a book before. It made me think of sort of video games where you have to kind of redo the same sequence to get it right. Like Adam Kadri's Varicella, for instance. Varicella, which is a game where you have to kind of get the sequence right to kill off various characters. You have to keep replaying it to get it right. Old Sierra games could be like that too, like The Colonel's Behest, which is a murder mystery one, you would end up reloading and reloading to get it right.
Yeah.
It just made me think a bit of a video game, almost like a reloading, basically.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it does mean that, yeah, the middle section of the book has this quite meandering structure.
Yeah, which I feel divided on, because I do think it works atmospherically. Overall, I do like this book. I think sometimes, I don't know, I guess it feels in the middle section like it's more focused on the mystery than the horror, and it does feel like there's not much being uncovered, or maybe it's just not working as mysteries tend to work. Like, there aren't that many kind of clues in a traditional sense. And, I mean, there are characters who reveal things, but there's... Mars doesn't kind of go about things in the way that a detective would, right? It would be interesting to see if this was adapted... And you can totally imagine it adapted for Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Very easily. Like a sort of 6-episode or 8-episode series. It would be interesting to see how they would manage the kind of middle section.
I think I enjoyed the journey of the book. I enjoyed all the atmospheric meandering. But there is quite a long section in the middle where you don't really feel like you've gained a lot more information about what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's just right. Like, okay, there's something weird with the honeys and the bees. But as we sort of get towards the end section, things do start picking up quite rapidly. We kind of get the victory cup with all these tournaments and sort of, you know, Mars's memories have been wiped, so they're sort of quite happily like joining in with the tournament.
Happily playing ultimate frisbee.
Yeah. and sort of at the end of the cup, sort of a bunch of them dive into the lake at night. They're sort of splashing about in the sort of silvery moonlight, and the honeys ask Mars to swim back with them to Cabin H. And so they do, and they sort of stay the night on the porch, and they all share stories about Caroline. It's a very, very sweet moment. But kind of after that, Mars remembers Sierra again, and sort of again, like, goes on another midnight mission, like steals Wyatt's keys, I think, and breaks into the computer lab, and sort of starts doing research on like missing people, and finds that there have been people sort of going missing around the woods for years, like in summer, in this area, and they think, oh, Cabin H has something to do with this, and the next morning they find out Braden's missing. So Mars is kind of determined to find out what's happening now, and kind of Wyatt follows them like out, so some derelict hotel kind of on the edge of the camp, that's all sort of the ceiling's kind of caved in, and the mush, the carpet is sort of mushy with mold, and the walls kind of swelling, and it sort of go down into the basement, and the whole basement has kind of become a hive. It's just filled with honeycomb. And this is where my texture comes back in.
Oh, this is where your delicious texture comes.
My delicious texture comes back in. They find Brayden. Okay. Wyatt flicks the flashlight into the corners, back and forth, until it snags on something moving along the honeycomb near us. A fluid twist, like many small bodies crawling over one another. But under the glare, it's just honeycomb, until it opens its eyes. Help me, it says. Please help me. It twists again, something huge beneath the comb, encased in it. A mouth, a nose, a strangely bent arm, a crumpled hand. A person. Brayden, Wyatt whispers. Please, I feel... Brayden shudders and the honeycomb creaks. Please, he begs. I hack at the comb with my hive tool, and Wyatt just uses his hands. The light whips around us as we pull down the delicate, sticky structure, digging until we find the naked body below. Brayden whimpers. He's badly hurt, but I can't see where. But I can smell the hurt, blood and a darker odour, sweet and rotten and thickening as we pry him out. I hear the bees and know they're angry. Their drone rises into an undulating siren, then a crackling threat. I drive my hands into the sticky shards, desperate now. Honey fills my nail beds, webs between my fingers, drips to my elbows. But Brayden is nearly free. Just another chunk, and... Brayden's weight does the rest. He slides from the comb, falling into Wyatt and blotting out the flashlight. I go to help, but then freeze. The flashlight has become a harsh glare caught between them. For a moment, it appears to pass right through Brayden, taking on the golden scarlet hue of his flesh, embryonic and quivering as he clings to Wyatt. Within him, I see a squiggly network of veins twisting together into mass that quite clearly pulses, his heart. Wyatt, I say, help me with him. Wyatt snaps and I rush forward. I grab Brayden's arm, and when I pull, his flesh slides right off the bone. I scream until I get the flopping sleeve unstuck from my hands. Brayden has crumpled between us, golden threads strung between him and Wyatt. Wyatt fumbles until he recovers the flashlight, aiming it at Brayden. Holes everywhere. Brayden's flesh is pocked in holes, clean and precise and weeping with honey. He cradles the bones of his hand with his remaining arm. His bones are soft too, like warm rubber. He looks at us and his eyes are scoops of yellow jelly in his skull. I don't feel... He jolts and gags. A tooth drips from his lips and lands without a sound in the honey pooling around him. I don't feel so good. I don't... We've got to get you to a doctor, Wyatt yells. He has to yell. The drone from the hives is loud now, furious. I feel a prick, then a needling pain in my neck. I've been stung. Another one gets my knee. I pull at Wyatt's back. Wyatt, we need to... Don't leave me! Brayden leaps at us, but his legs buckle beneath him and he falls. His skeletal hand drags over Wyatt's chest, catching on the keys, tearing them off. The flashlight thuds into the honey, aimed upwards into Brayden. The light passes through him. Like a jack-o'-lantern, he glows an eerie gold, his bones black and twisting below his viscous, dotted flesh. Brayden screams again, his lower jaw yawning wide until it falls to the floor. Brayden implodes with it, smothering the flashlight. The light flickers beneath the quivering mass, flickers again, then goes out.
Ah.
Hey, it didn't even make me want to enjoy a nice, delicious pot of honey.
No.
No.
You don't want to enjoy a delicious pot of man honey?
Well, of which there's plenty. So that's sort of the revelation that follows from this, right? Is that,
yeah.
Is that everyone's hooked on man honey.
This is one of their most holy rituals, what they did to Brayden, to fortify the hive, and it produces this this deep red honey. It's a It's like, and Mars kind of asks, like, Honey's like, what did you do? And they're like, well, it's very like Little Shop of Horrors, like, the guy sure looks like plant food to me. It's like the guy sure looks like bee food to me. They're like, well, he was, but this is the other revelation, is that, like, he deserved it, right? He was like, kind of sexually harassing one of the honeys kind of over the last year, and, you know, getting her to send him.
Thoroughly dirt bag, basically.
Yeah. And this is why he's become bee food. So they kind of, the honeys sort of get Mars to eat the cannibal honeycomb. And this is sort of another so they have this feast, they have this cannibal honey feast of these sort of shapes of honeycomb, and it says, my eyes are stuck on the edge of the closest platter, where within the comb I can see the clear impression of a nose. I follow the slope up to a bro bone. The socket is empty. The eye melted away. So they have this cannibal honey feast. It's very, I think this came first. It's very similar to, very reminiscent of a memorable scene in Yellow Jackets.
I still haven't seen two. It. Yeah.
You'll know the one if you've seen it.
I haven't. So, but the listeners.
Very similar atmosphere there. So they draw Mars into this interconnected honey network, which they called the lace. And that's where sort of Mars sees kind of what the girl that Brayden was tormenting, and sort of learns the internet connections with everything.
So that the honey is are like the Traumafrodors, the aliens in Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5, in that they can see all of the past and all of the future and all of the present simultaneously.
And so they're
being used by the deep state for prophecies to help the economy, possibly.
Yeah.
So it was Bill and Hillary all along.
Yeah, it was. So Mars like escapes and like kind of they kind of realize that like the Hive wants them to be its new queen. There's this sort of revelation that Wyatt, because sort of Wyatt and Mars have had this kind of romantic tension, and they escape to an abandoned barn, and they're sort of just like kissing, but then Wyatt's sort of taken over by this bee.
It was funny, you're gonna get some like some tender young adult romance stuff, and it's like, no, you're not. It's more bee horror.
The last
I don't know, quarter, maybe fifth of this book, it just goes into all out kind of unhinged horror. It becomes really wild.
So like the kind of the honeys rescue Mars from Wyatt, and they're about to kill Wyatt, but then because they realize that he killed Sierra, but then Mars tells them that Wyatt's a drone, and it turns out it's a rogue swarm led by Mimi, who was mad about Caroline being made queen of the Hive and about Mars being let in at all because they're gender fluid. And so Mimi gets incinerated by bees. Mars runs away to the Applebee's, and
Like Applebee's, I get it now. Applebee's, like apple with like bees, like a bee. Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it's all coming together. And like calls their parents to come and get them. They're like, please, Bill and Hillary, come and get me. But when the parents turn up, it turns out they have Caroline's mummified corpse in the trunk of the car.
Yes, they do.
And Mars, they're kidnapped and wakes up in the honey basement, they're in honey.
Yeah, yeah.
They are encased in honey, and there are a cult of adults in the building, all in their robes and veils, who have grown rich from the predictions of the honeys. Some of which include, like, winning the lottery, I think. They can't all be the lottery, right? Because that would get suspicious.
I think, yeah, that would be a bit suspicious, to be honest.
but various financial predictions have ensured the wealth of this of the baby boomers. And so, yeah, it sort of turns out only sort of right at the end, you know, kind of we finally learn the true position of the honeys in all of this, is that they're kind of being used by the adults,
the evil baby boomers.
And so the kind of Wendy and Mars's parents are sort of talking about how Caroline wasn't a fit vessel for the queen of the hive, and it was like her reign failed, but that Mars is going to be the next vessel, and so the queendom passes from Caroline to Mars, and Caroline and Mars sort of meet in the honey realm.
it all gets really astral at this point.
And she sort of explains kind of what happens, that like that her reign failed, and like, you know, her parents are putting all this pressure on her to, you know, keep the conspiracy, well, it's not good, the confederacy, the honey confederacy going. And they sort of, what happened on the night that started the book is that they brought her back from Aspen and locked her in her room, in a room in the basement, and told her to kill herself, basically. And they're like, but don't hurt your body too much, because we need it for Mars to be the next queen. All right, see you, kid.
Yeah, guys, really grim.
Yeah. but instead, she managed to crawl out the window and up the side of the house and onto, through Mars's, you know, bedroom window, and, you know, she sort of explains that she wanted to save them from all of this.
But actually it's a happy ending, because Mars gets to be the new queen of the bees, and sounds pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. Like, and Mars's first task as queen is to kill Bria, but instead, they fling the hive tool at one of the veiled figures, which turns out to be Wendy. The sort of the last chapter is them sort of in their meadow with the bees and the honeys, and some police come and tell them that, unfortunately, their parents' house is burned down and incinerated. Incinerated the parents, we know from the narration that this was Mars's doing somehow. But yes, they're like, I'll just stay here, I think. and Mars and the honeys are ready to fight against the baby boomers and the honey confederacy. So yeah, it's a cracking ending.
Oh yeah, yeah. The ending's terrific. It's funny because I obviously mentioned I hadn't really made the connection before, but I mentioned the substance right at the start of this episode. And actually, it's kind of similar in that, like, I was enjoying it well enough, but then, you know, the kind of last quarter or so, I was like, yeah, now this is the good stuff. And it just became kind of more and more wild and strange. And yeah, I really Goopy. Enjoyed it. Yeah.
I appreciated how much it went for it with the honey horror.
Yeah.
The yawning honey jaw.
Yeah, that's a pretty... And, you know, really, I've seen jaws drop off before, you know, in films, but never never with strands of honey, you know.
Yeah.
Them, so.
Yeah.
That's good. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for coming along with me on this honey journey, Adam.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad it was delicious.
Mm. As ever, don't know what we're doing next time.
Oh, well, I was thinking, have you watched or read any of The Promised Neverland?
No.
Okay, because it's pretty popular with the kids. And it's a manga and anime. Although apparently the second season is atrocious. I've only watched the first season, which is brilliant. And read the equivalent manga volumes. But yeah, it's about kids.
Oh, no, I did start watching this, actually. In an orphanage,
yeah, that isn't what it seems. And it's definitely, you know, horror for teenagers.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, maybe we could do that then.
Yeah, it's good. I'm pretty keen. And it has obvious similarities with The Drifting Classroom, which we've done before, which I'm confident is an influence.
Excellent. I mean, I do love it when we can make connections between things. Great.
Okay. Right. Do you want to credits?
Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find the details in the show notes. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't see how I don't know if I need an Instagram to see it. Because I'm finding...
Yeah, I think you do now.
I
think
you do, because I can't see Instagram anymore without an account. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to see... Maybe you could send me your collage for the last episode.
Well, I didn't do one.
Oh, okay.
But I will.
Okay. That's all right, then.
Do you have a sign up for us, Adam?
Yeah, I'll just say, let it be, creepy kids.
Let it be. All right. See you next time, creepy kids.
Bye.
Bye.